Philadelphia-based catering service providing Southern-style cuisine, Grandma Joyce can be reached through Facebook at Grandma Joyce's Kitchen. Dinner was provided by Brazil Grill. Locally owned and operated, Brazil Grill serves up Brazilian steak with the traditional churrasco method. Located in Portland's downtown arts district at 1201 Southwest 12th Avenue, Brazil Grill is open daily for dinner. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 right now.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m. KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the...
You're listening to KBOO, Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up next is the news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on our hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, there's a move to regulate Creighton in Oregon.
Oregon is having a very late flood season.
And the head of the Department of Homeland Security, Kirsten Nielsen, has either quit or she was fired.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 8th, 2019. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we need you. We'd like you to become a member during our newscast tonight by calling 877-500-5266. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ken Jones. The herb Creighton might soon be regulated in Oregon. Made from the leaves of a tree native to Southeast Asia, Creighton, when ingested, can have the impact of a stimulant or can act like an opioid, depending on the dosage. It's commonly used to treat chronic pain and sometimes opioid withdrawal symptoms. It's currently unregulated and available at gas stations and smoke shops. The Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to consider a proposal to regulate Creighton tomorrow morning. If passed, it would limit the amount of one component of Creighton, and that component is 7-hydroxymetragonine used in the state.
An alleged Antifa protester was acquitted of federal charges by a judge last Friday. John Hacker was accused of failing to comply with federal officers at a Patriot prayer rally, which took place at Terry Schrunk Plaza on June 30th of last year. Video of Hacker's arrest shows him standing in place and arguing with officers, telling them they had no right to exclude anyone from the plaza. Then suddenly, he is surrounded by officers, handcuffed, and taken away. Hacker's attorney argued that Patriot prayer demonstration permit specifically stipulated that the rally could not block the entrances to the park and could not exclude members of the general public from the park. The permit did not allow Patriot Prayer or the Proud Boys to exclude members of the public from their free speech rally. That's why, Hacker's attorney said, the federal law enforcement order was unlawful, because the arresting officer was not upholding the requirements of the permit, but rather, quote, doing the bidding of the permit holders.
The murder trial of Jeremy Christian will not be moved out of Multnomah County. That was the ruling today by Multnomah County Circuit Judge Cheryl Albrecht. On May 26, 2017, Christian stabbed to death TriMet commuters Ricky Best and Talisha Namkai Meshe and seriously injured Micah David Cole Fletcher as the three men tried to defend two Islamic girls from Christian's white supremacist tirade. Christian's attorney argued in court that his client's life and views are too well known locally and would prevent him from getting a fair trial. The judge said in her ruling that the court can begin its jury selection process, but that if it becomes clear jurors can't be impartial, then she might rule the trial be moved to a different county. Lawyers and the judge are scheduled to begin the process of selecting a jury on June 14th. The 5-week trial is scheduled to start June 24th. In other action Monday, the judge also ruled that if Christian is found guilty of aggravated murders in the deaths of Ricky Best and Talisha Namkai Meshe, prosecutors can seek the death penalty.
And a Washington man has been arrested and charged with 2 felonies, this time related to a bomb threat and a plot to kill 30 Jews. The FBI was tipped off by the Anti-Defamation League last fall. They pointed out this man has made many hateful anti-Semitic posts on as many as 7 different Facebook accounts. He claims to be a member of the Ku Klux Klan and posted violent fantasies on social media. He was arrested last December, and police found military equipment, gas masks, and a large number of firearms. He was officially charged last week with 2 counts of threats to bomb or injure property. He is not charged with a hate crime at this time. His arraignment will be April 18th.
Nearly 600 million birds are killed each year from collisions with buildings. Researchers at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology have published a list of the most dangerous cities. Portland is not one of them. The total number of migratory birds is in the billions. One of the risks they face is light pollution in big cities. Chicago, Houston, and Dallas are at the top of the list, partly because those cities are positioned at the heart of the most trafficked aerial corridors. And they also tend to have lots of skyscrapers. The Audubon Society of Houston uses migration forecasts to run a lights-out warning on nights when large migratory movements are expected over the city.
And in more news about the animals around us, 20 years after being reintroduced to the state, Oregon wolves are living wild in record numbers, according to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department. Officials said today that 137 known wolves are wandering in our state, which is believed to be at least a 10% population increase from last year. 16 packs, defined as 4 or more wolves traveling together in winter, were documented during the winter count. That's up from 12 packs in 2017. However, officials say the increase appears to have mostly taken place in eastern Oregon. In the western parts of the state, wolves are still few and far between. The state's wildlife biologists say the goal for stabilizing wolf populations in western Oregon is that 4 breeding pairs would establish themselves in central and western Oregon for 3 years. In the western half of the state, that has not yet been achieved, but in the eastern half, there are more than 7 breeding wolf pairs. In California, 1 pack has established itself, with the breeding male being an offspring of a wolf that had wandered south from Oregon in 2011.
The U.S. is warming twice as fast as the rest of the world. That story and more on HTO Radio's weekly news report about water.
This country is warming twice as fast as the rest of the world. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
20 million people in Venezuela have experienced widespread water shortages in the last 2 months due to electricity disruptions affecting delivery systems. In some places, there is no water for up to 2 weeks.
People in Caracas depend on electrical pumps to get water up to their city's 3,000-foot level. Ordinary citizens of all classes have been driven into the streets to search for water, regardless of whether it's potable.
The Washington Post reports that some residents have to get water from creeks so they can bathe, drink, and cook. Toilets can't be flushed nor kitchens cleaned.
The regime in power, that of Nicolas Maduro, places the blame for the water crisis on the U.S. and the opposition for sabotage. Juan Guaido, the leader of the opposition, blames government mismanagement and corruption.
Thousands of Venezuelans protested on Saturday, backing opposition leader Guaido, according to Reuters.
Runoff in the Upper Missouri River Basin during March far exceeded the previous record set in 1952, causing extreme flooding from Iowa to Nebraska and Kansas.
Yale Climate Connections reports that the causes of the inundation go back to last summer's heavy rains that continued into the fall, saturating soils. Then in mid-March, with snow sitting on top of frozen soil, the bomb cyclone hit, bringing heavy rain. climate change has made wetter weather more common in the Midwest.
Eartha reports that the consequences from the flooding could include a large dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico as nutrient-laden waters flow into the Mississippi River.
Another problem from the flooding is that farmers will not be compensated for the millions of bushels of grain in storage that were damaged or destroyed. The federal government has no insurance for that type of disaster.
Some communities along the Missouri are still struggling to restore drinking water weeks after the flooding. The Associated Press reports that in one Iowa community, officials had to use a boat last week to reach facilities to make repairs, and it still could be a couple of weeks before completion. In a Nebraska town, it could be 6 months before the water treatment plant is operating.
The flooding has started a movement by the Republican governors of Nebraska, Missouri, and Iowa to demand more authority over management of the Missouri River, saying that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers should prioritize flood control over things such as protecting fish and wildlife habitat.
There's a national wildlife refuge in the city of New Orleans called Bayou Sauvage, home to 340 species of birds. Late last month, the U.S. government continued a practice there that's been going on for more than 20 years.
10,000 dead Christmas trees were dropped into the bayou to build ecological resilience in marshlands and lagoons.
The trees are collected in New Orleans and are bundled in groups of about 75. Then the National Guard uses helicopters to airlift them to drop sites.
The manager of the refuge told Earther that the dead Christmas trees are placed to absorb the energy of waves to reduce shoreline erosion and trap silt, keeping waters clear. When the waters are clear, more sunlight can reach submerged vegetation, which is food for waterfowl. The dead trees also serve as a platform where new plants can grow.
Another benefit to the program? The trees don't end up in a landfill where they decompose, releasing methane, a potent greenhouse gas.
Canada is warming up from climate change at twice the rate of the rest of the world, according to a new report. The average temperature there is 1.7 degrees Celsius, or 3 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than it was 70 years ago, about twice the global average increase. Northern parts of the country are warming even more.
A government agency commissioned the report, which also concludes that the warming already produced by carbon dioxide emissions from human activity is effectively irreversible.
The Guardian reports that scientists don't fully understand the reasons for the increased temperatures in Canada, but melting snow and ice reveal darker, warmer surfaces that don't reflect the sun's heat. The retreat of glaciers and disappearing sea ice contribute to a feedback loop that increases warming.
The increased warmth will lead to greater precipitation in places and also more severe heat waves and higher risks of drought and wildfires.
Canada has some of the largest carbon emissions in the world due to oil, gas, and petrochemical industries, and people there drive the least efficient vehicles, eat a lot of beef, and fly often. Some provinces still burn a lot of coal.
The report says that the only way to keep global temperature rise in line with targets set by the Paris Climate Summit is for global emissions to peak almost immediately, to be followed by rapid and deep reductions. And finally, airplane bathrooms suck, both literally and figuratively. Not only do you have to maneuver into tiny spaces to do your business, you have to brace yourself for the loud sucking sound when you flush. That noise not only terrifies small children, but can reverberate throughout the cabin.
Although planes have become lighter and more efficient, toilets haven't changed. That's because getting airplane toilets to flush with very little water requires a vacuum, which at 38,000 feet pulls air at nearly half the speed of sound. When things move at that speed, any disturbance to the flow, like the bend of a pipe or a valve opening or closing, generates significant noise.
But take heart, frequent flyers. Researchers at Brigham Young University have invented a toilet that's about half as loud.
According to a university press release, to solve the problem, the BYU team focused on three valve positions that are noisy during the flush cycle. They added additional piping to increase distances between the toilet bowl and the flush valve and made the pipes more of a gradual bend rather than a sharp 90-degree angle.
The quieter commode was simple physics, they say, and note that current airplane toilets can easily be retrofitted with their design.
The vacuum-assisted toilets could also be used on cruise ships and trains, and even in new buildings to reduce water use, The sky's the limit.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
And we continue the stream of water news with a report that recent rainfall is causing unseasonable flooding in western Oregon. According to the National Weather Service, there is only one other time in recent history that northwest Oregon has seen river flooding in April. That was in April of 2012. The last several days of rain and melting snow have caused swollen streams and rivers, prompting a flash flood watch in parts of western Oregon. The Willamette is expected to reach flood stage in Albany and Corvallis early next week, and flash flooding is also possible in the Columbia River Gorge and near the Eagle Creek Fire Burn area.
You're listening to an hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can call to renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by calling 877-500-5266. Stay tuned after this newscast for our KBOO News In-Depth interview with Kendall Duffy, creator of the Portland Veterans Project, then its Labor Radio at 6 and Hard Knock Radio at 7. Tonight's weather, showers likely, and possibly a thunderstorm, mostly cloudy with a low around 46. Tomorrow, showers likely, mainly before 11 a.m., partly sunny with a high near 57. Today in history, the year was 1935 and the Works Progress Administration, also known as the WPA, is approved by Congress. And in 1952, President Truman ordered the seizure of U.S. steel mills to prevent a strike. The quote of the day is from George Carlin, who said, "When you're born, you get a ticket to the freak show. When you're born in America, you get a front row seat."
We're going deep with this next story, deep into the ocean, that is. A consortium of four private companies in Russia have been capturing and storing whales for sale to aquariums in China and other countries. The exportation of marine mammals, by the way, is illegal. 11 orcas and 87 beluga whales have been held in cramped enclosures in a bay by the Sea of Japan. This activity was first reported about a year ago and caused much consternation among animal rights groups and around the world. Some 900,000 signatures have been gathered online in petitions, and the whales will be released by government decree, but it might take some time to find the right way to do it so that the whales are not harmed further.
Lakefront landscaping is key to water quality. It's time for CurrentCast.
Less lawn, more native landscaping for our lakes. On today's CurrentCast. You might like the look of a clean-cut lawn, but if you have lakefront property, experts say not to mow all the way to the shoreline.
The most important thing you can do for your lake is to create a buffer zone. And this is a patch of native plants along the lakeshore.
That's landscape architect Fred Rosamulski. He says even modest buffers can trap pollutants such as fertilizers and loose soils before they reach a lake. While the roots of a plant in a buffer zone prevent erosion, the flowers and branches provide valuable habitat for wildlife. And these buffers don't need to keep people away. Grass paths can provide eco-friendly access to the lake. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future, supported by New York's Environmental Protection Fund and Sea Grant, online at currentcast.org.
KBOO volunteers have stepped up their game to bring you this locally produced newscast every single evening. So now we are asking you to step up as well. Joining us now are Jamie and Gwen to talk about how you can support KBOO Community Radio. Take it away, Jamie and Gwen.
Hey, Michelle and Ken, thank you. Good evening. You've been listening to the KBOO Evening News, and it's the KBOO Spring Membership Drive. So I want you to go to your phone right now and dial 877-500-5266 and become a KBOO member. or make a secure donation online at kboo.fm. I'm Jamie. I'm a volunteer programmer on KBOO's Labor Radio, and I'm joined here by Gwen. Hey, Gwen. Yes. Another Jamie. Volunteer. We're thrilled to be on the evening news and to share with you why it's important for you to support KBOO right now.
Yeah, it's like what you've been listening to. The evening news is all put together by volunteers and some staff members that help out and do that. So this news, it's searched out, it's found, it's recorded, it's brought into the station by different volunteers and community members. And, you know, your donation helps keep this going. So we are asking a $10 donation. That's $120 or $10 a month.
Mm-hmm.
There's several appreciation things. These aren't like you're buying them. These are you donate and we give you these for showing our appreciation. We have some great, what did we call these, book packages?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's two different book packages. There is also a couple of great t-shirts, a bag, hoodie. All these things are given in appreciation for your donations. So the number is 877-500-5266. And the thing is if you're driving, if you're really busy at the moment, you can't do it, make yourself a note, you know, do a hands-free note on your phone or something.
Pull over.
Yeah, well, there you go. Pull right over and just find a convenient place to park, and it'll only take a second. Give us a call at 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
And we want to thank Devin for new membership. Devin got a knit cap. Devin from Northeast Portland. Must have donated $60 or $5 a month, and you can do the same. We encourage a regular donation. It's as easy as going to the website and clicking on our donate button and putting in your credit card or bank account number, and it just comes out. You hardly even notice it every month, and it keeps us sustainable.
Yeah. We have phone operators standing by waiting for your call. It makes it so easy. There's several different ways to donate. You can also just walk in the front door and say, hey, I'd like to donate. And there's people here that'll be happy to take that donation and show you around. So, you know, we're an open door here. You can come in. You can see what your money is paying for. You can see who's involved here. You can meet the staff. You can meet some volunteers. All this is about being involved and keeping connected to the community.
That's right, Gwen. And we want folks to go right to their phones, 877-500-5266, or on the web at kboo.fm. Our theme for the spring membership drive is Smash Fascism, Restore Humanity. And you heard the first three stories on the local news tonight were about fighting the fascist threat. One of them, a court case where an anti-fascist protester got off, and two, unfortunately, about the further development of fascist activity in our community. But you won't find this kind of news anywhere but on KBOO, and it's the evening news is produced here every weekday by volunteers, researched, written, read by volunteers who care like you do about building a progressive movement to change our community and our nation. So if you are part of this movement, and we know you are, it's time to move from being just a listener to becoming a member. Go to 877-500-5266 and donate online.
You know, the other thing is if you're new in town, if you're new to the Portland area and you're looking for people to meet, you're looking for something to be involved in, you want to help support the local community, KBOO is the deal. You can come down, meet people. There's all kinds of stuff going on all the time. Different ways to be involved, different events going on all year long. So jump on the phone, 877-500-5266, or online at kboo.fm.
That's right. Support the news you can use. Say yes to KBOO. Say yes to social change. Say yes to giving voice to the voiceless. Say yes to human rights and decency in the world. Say yes to community radio. Go to kboo.fm or 877-500-5266. And we encourage you to donate $10 a month.
Yeah. So our newscasters tonight, Ken and Michelle, they're here. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly how many days a week Ken and Michelle come in, but they're here and they put their efforts in as volunteers to do this because, you know, they feel like being a part of the show, there's important news that's brought up, and it's news that's not just local, it's also what's happening internationally and nationally, but it's all put out in a way that is important to KBOO's efforts towards smashing fascism. I have a tough trouble. I'm having trouble with that word tonight. Say it for me.
Smash fascism.
Fascism. That's right. Smashing it. So jump on the phone, jump online, 877-500-5266 or kboo.fm.
Thanks, Jamie and Gwen. Now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native American health advocates are weighing in on the legal battle over the Affordable Care Act. Maxine Spire reports if the federal law is removed, it could end significant gains for Indian health care.
If the Affordable Care Act is dismantled, that would also strip away laws that provide funding for Indian health care. The National Indian Health Board, along with nearly 500 tribes and tribal organizations, have filed a brief with the court that will soon be deciding whether to uphold a federal judge's December ruling that the Obama-era Health Care Act is unconstitutional. Devin Delro is the director of policy at the National Indian Health Board. He says that no matter what the court decides for the fate of the ACA, specific provisions for Native Americans within the act need to be protected.
Those provisions are completely severable from the ACA, so they should remain intact and should not be struck down.
Delro says that protecting the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act, or IKIA, is his group's main priority. IKIA allows the Indian Health Service to be reimbursed by Medicare, Medicaid, and other third-party insurers. It's been around since 1976, but was permanently reauthorized in 2010 when it was embedded into the Affordable Care Act.
The loss of IKEA and those other provisions would certainly have a really devastating impact.
It's an impact that would be felt by tribal and urban Indian health centers across the country and would strain an already chronically underfunded system. When Congress tried to repeal and replace the ACA back in 2017, Delro says the National Indian Health Board worked with legislators to make sure that every piece of new legislation introduced preserved IKEA and other Indian-specific provisions.
Because members of Congress realize Indian health care is a bipartisan priority.
For now, while the Indian health care system and the ACA remain intertwined, advocates like Delro will have to wait to see how things unfold in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. For National Native News, I'm Maxine Spire.
A bill on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls is making its way through the Arizona legislature. The bill commissions a first-of-its-kind study to show the causes and find solutions. KNAU's Ryan Heinches reports.
Authorities say existing data on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls is sparse, and no comprehensive study has ever been done statewide or nationally. The Arizona bill aims to fill in the information gaps of why violence against Native women is up to 10 times higher than the national average. Democratic State Representative Jennifer Germain is its sponsor.
The fact that we are just now first starting to talk about it in 2019, I think, echoes the problem. This is something that has been happening in our country for centuries. Indigenous women have gone missing throughout the entire history of the United States.
Domestic violence, human trafficking, and sex trade are all contributing factors. Germain says another major hurdle is poor communication between tribal, county, municipal, and state law enforcement agencies. When the study is complete, a task force will recommend legislation and other measures. The Arizona bill was passed unanimously by the state house, and a vote in the full Senate is expected soon. If it becomes law, it would dovetail with an effort in the U.S. House, led by New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haaland, to combat missing and murdered indigenous women on a federal level. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Macaw Nation in Washington State could land up to 2 gray whales over 10 years for ceremonial and subsistence purposes under a federal proposal announced last week. The tribe has long requested to resume the hunt, but has faced opposition, including from animal rights groups. The proposal does not allow the hunts to begin, but is a step closer. A judge is scheduled to review the proposal in August. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the law offices of Sanofsky Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska, and online at www.sanofsky.com.
My day one.
Telling inspiring stories of alcohol recovery. Recovery works. Hope starts here. Go to recoveralaska.org to learn more.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
And the news continues. President Trump's second Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, resigned on Sunday after 16 months in office. During her tenure, Nielsen enforced Trump's controversial policies, cracking down on migrants and asylum seekers and separating children from their parents at the southern border. Trump publicly criticized Nielsen's weakness and failure to curb illegal border crossings, while she maintained that federal law and international obligations limited her actions. Kevin McAleenan, a commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, has been named acting secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, leaving the nation's top two immigration agencies without a leader. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, quote, "It is deeply alarming that the Trump administration official who put children in cages is reportedly resigning because she is not extreme enough for the White House's liking."
Rebel forces in eastern Libya have begun surprise attacks against Tripoli. These attacks put the nation into a virtual state of civil war. The U.S. has moved some of its forces out of Libya due to security conditions on the ground. The head of U.S. Africa Command says the security realities are becoming complex and unpredictable. India has also withdrawn a small group of peacekeeping troops. Tripoli's only airport for civilian use is now closed after an air raid attack. The World Health Organization said that two doctors were killed trying to evacuate wounded patients from conflict areas. Expect innocent people to die and oil prices to rise.
You're listening to an hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, and we could certainly use your support. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Melinda Wolfer. The producer is Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. And the interim KABU Evening News Director is the wonderful Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Philomath on translator K282BH at 104.3 FM, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, an alternative radio, they talk about the financialization of housing with guest Leilani Farha. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on stage and studio, D'Mae Roberts features two all-female theater productions opening on the same weekend. We talk with actress Sarah Hennessy in How to Keep an Alien at Carib Theater and director Jocelyn Side of A Dark Sky Full of Stars at Theater Vertigo. At 11:30, Art Focus talks to artists, critics, and curators. All of these KABU programs are made possible by member support. Support our spring membership drive by becoming a new member. Just go to kboo.fm and click on donate. Good night, Michelle.
Good night, Ken.
Good night, Danielle.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Our in-depth guest today is Kendall Duffy, a high school senior in Portland and creator of the Portland Veterans Project. The Portland Veterans Project is a website dedicated to the stories of Portland's military veterans as told by those who served in World War II up to our nation's more recent conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq. Kendall interviewed each veteran and transcribed the recordings for the website with the goal of sharing these experiences with the greater community. She started the project in June 2017 and has continued to add to it. Kendall's here in the KABU studios to talk about the Portland Veterans Project and share a few of those experiences with us. Kendall Duffy, welcome to KABU.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Kendall, first a little background on you and the project. The inspiration came from a school trip you made to Washington, D.C., particularly a stop at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Late at night, huh?
Yes. So when I was a sophomore in high school, I had the chance to go on a Civil War winterum. So my school does this thing called winterum. The week before spring vacation, we get to sign up for some sort of experiential trip, whether that be international, domestic, or a local trip. And I did a domestic trip. We went to Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and then DC, exploring different sites of the Civil War and learning about the history there. And we ended our trip at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in D.C. We were running super late, so we got there, and it was basically abandoned. And we had the chance to go through and really experience it one-on-one. And while I was there, I just became really curious about the stories behind every name that was on the wall and their lives and what had happened before they'd ended up on the wall. So that's kind of how I started to think about the idea, and I decided when I'd come home, I'd learn more about it. So I did.
Now, when you decided to start the project, so there you had the spark of it. Mm-hmm. Did you seek advice or assistance from your teachers, or did you do pretty much all this yourself? I mean, it's an amazing website and a wealth of material there. Even you had somebody design a logo.
I did, yeah. I had a lot of help, some mentors kind of along the way. The first person who really influenced me and really helped me was the guide of the trip. Our school hired him to come help. He works with the school a lot for these trips. His name is Ron Silver. He's a local of Portland. He does a lot of trips like this. And he asked us the question, at the end of the trip, what are we going to do with the knowledge that we have now? And I just took it really seriously. I took it literally. And I thought, okay, well, I want to learn more about Portland's veterans. So I certainly didn't think it was going to become this, but I thought, I'll just learn about them. Let's see. So I came home and I just became curious about the people in my own life who had served in the military who I didn't know about. So I started by interviewing. My very first interview was with a man who I knew from the church where I work. I knew he was a Korean War veteran, but I didn't know anything about that experience except for the bumper sticker on his car. So I asked him if I could interview him, and he agreed, and I didn't know what I would ask him or how it would go, so I borrowed some questions from the veterans.
Oh, it's the, I looked them up. It's actually on your website, the guidelines for the Library of Congress's Veterans right. History Project.
Yes, so the Veterans History Project that the Library of Congress did, I think it was more like before I was born in like the late 90s, 80s, 70s with those veterans, but they still had all those questions online. So I took some from there. I formulated some of my own based on my own curiosities. And then I asked him about them. And I really just thought it was going to be kind of a one-time thing, maybe just learn some history, see what happens. But he was actually able to tell me about his experience with Bomb Blast Bravo in the Korean War. And I'd actually had the chance to learn about that in history. And I immediately made the connection of, well, I can learn about something in history, or I can hear someone who experienced it tell me about it. And that really strengthened my own understanding and appreciation. So that was how that started. My first interview was a huge success, so I wanted to keep doing it. I had a friend design the logo for me. Her name's Audrey Mester. She's a fantastic artist.
Yeah, it's a beautiful logo.
Yeah, she's a fantastic artist, photographer. I'm really so grateful that she did that for me. And I'm just really glad that I've been able to show the logo to people and have it be part of my project, because I think it really brings the whole thing together. So I'm so grateful for her for that. But those are the people who like really influenced me to begin my project. Ron, the first person I interviewed, and then Audrey really all helped me begin.
Now, from those humble beginnings,
yes.
You've now done over 50 interviews.
Yes.
Starting in July 2017 was the first one with the Korean War vet.
Yes.
To the present. And you interviewed my dad.
I did. Yes, I did.
And he's a 92-year-old World War II veteran.
He was
in the Navy. Fortunately, didn't see any combat.
Yes.
He was delivered the mail in Rhode Island, actually. But he was very young. I was amazed, Kendall, how calm and polished and skilled you were. I've been doing this for a few years, and it's not easy.
No, it's not. Not at all.
How has your interview process changed over that time? Were you nervous in the beginning, and then just things became a little bit more manageable and easier as you went along? And
absolutely. I think that I became a lot more confident in my skills and what I was saying. I realized as I began doing the interviews more and more often that people are going to give you the level of detail that they're comfortable with. So I've gotten really comfortable asking a question and allowing for some silence, allowing for time to think. And I think that's something that's changed over the interview time, not to just fill time with asking extra questions, but to give people time to really reflect. And I think that's really come across in my more recent interviews compared to the first ones, because the questions have more to do with like their childhood or more specific experiences after their service or during their experience. And those questions are formulated from others' answers. So previous interviews give me ideas for questions I want to ask in the future and things like that.
Well, I have to emphasize again, it was just amazing. I was sitting there kind of just, this is incredible. She's a high school senior, and I'm jealous. I wish I was that good. Now, you've talked with veterans from World War II, as I mentioned, all the way up to the fighting in Afghanistan, Iraq. How do you find your subjects now? So was there a little network you established after that first interview and through the church?
Yeah, so I really started by word of mouth. So the first veterans that I interviewed, I asked them, hey, if you know anyone else who you think might be willing to talk, let me know, send them my way. So I really started by working through people who knew each other, people who knew of someone else who they thought might be interested. From there, once I kind of began to accumulate a wealth of these interviews and had some experience to back up what I was doing, I began working with some veterans groups in Portland. NAVVETS, the National Association of Black Veterans. I've worked with the LGBTQ Veterans Office of Oregon.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that.
Yeah, we'll do that.
That was fascinating.
VetWork, which is a veterans networking company or group here in Portland, along with retirement homes. So I reach out to retirement homes, usually to activities directors, and then they usually work to set me up with either the leader of a veterans group at a specific retirement home, a resident who has really taken it upon themselves to work with the other veterans, or just activities directors, staff at these places who know their residents and who might be willing.
It seems like most of them are willing then. Do you get anybody turning you down?
Oh, yes, all the time.
What are usually the reasons?
I think it's because, well, I actually have never been to an interview where someone has said no once I've gotten there and like to my face. I've had people just think about it and say, you know, I don't remember my experiences too clearly. That happens sometimes with the older folks that I'm interviewing. I've also had people say that this happens more frequently with more current wars, so Iraq and Afghanistan, along with some Vietnam veterans who have said, you know what, I'm still getting comfortable with my experiences.
It's too painful.
I'm not ready to talk about it right now, and you know, that's completely okay, and I really respect that decision because I never would want to force someone to talk about something that they're not willing to. I always say in the beginning of my interviews, it's completely up to you how much detail you want to give. If you want to skip a question, please let me know. Like, it's your interview, it's your story. Let yourself dictate what you share. Yeah.
Now, you talked about some people who you feel, based on their age, they might not remember that clearly. What struck me while reading the interviews was, even though many of these veterans are in their 80s and 90s, the World War II veterans, and even Korean, they have crystal clear, very detailed memories of their wartime experiences. I mean, it was like a minute-by-minute account. was that surprising to you?
Or? Absolutely. I think definitely something to strive for, as, you know, I think also it helps that a lot of them have thought about these experiences a lot, have grappled with them throughout their life, but a lot of them have moments that really changed the way that they saw the outlook of the world, or where they felt personally like their worldview was shaking, whether that was like a close call in combat or they witnessed something that really is upsetting or off-putting. I mean, it's amazing some of the things I loved listening to. I think your dad actually mentioned it, and a few other people, listening to the radio programs as children. One person was able to tell me about play-by-play of his favorite like Lone Ranger episode, which I thought was pretty cool. I tried to find it later because I was just so curious.
I wasn't even alive during that time. Yeah, I've listened to all those.
Yeah.
Now the interviews, you kind of implied it. Mm-hmm. They clearly bring up a lot of memories, good and bad.
Yeah.
Has that at times been a very emotional experience for the veteran you've been talking with and you as well?
Absolutely.
As the listener?
Yes. It has happened more frequently, actually. I've been making a real effort in the past few months to reach out specifically to World War II veterans because the window is getting smaller and smaller to talk to these people and to record their stories. And so it's been an emotional experience hearing these stories. They're talking about a world that just doesn't exist anymore, whether that be the society, the culture, the worldview. There's definitely been some experiences, you know, I've had people cry in interviews before. I've cried in interviews before, whether that be talking about their moms who have been gone for 50 or 60 years. talking about the dogs, the bomb dogs in Vietnam who died pretty regularly.
And their friends probably, their too, friends, who died in combat.
Yeah. I had the opportunity to talk to a man who was part of the liberation of Mauthausen concentration camp. And that was a very emotional experience for the both of us, him recounting it and myself hearing it. But it's the stories that really make a person human that are the ones that have the biggest impact. People cry thinking about seeing their wives for the first time after 3 years or their children. It's a very humanizing experience hearing from a person who, from what their experiences have been, you might think was hardened or cold-hearted. Not cold-hearted, but very, protected, that they still have those emotional memories.
Yeah, I have one passage I'd like to read here.
Sure,
That struck me, and this was from a 97-year-old World War II vet. So this is something that happened when he was very young and a long, long time ago, yet he's still grappling with it. And this is on Kendall's website, of course. He says, when you're face to face with Germans and they're shooting at you and you have to shoot back, it's either they're going to kill you or you're going to kill them. I have an aversion to killing people. I try to wound them, but sometimes you can't. They're shooting right at you, right at your face. You have to shoot back. And you don't know whether you're going to kill them or not. That's the most horrible thing to me. I have a conscience, and I still have nightmares about that. What are you feeling at times like that? I was almost tearing up reading about it. It must have been extremely difficult for him. He had to do it. He had no choice. He was being shot at, and yet it's still bothering him.
Yeah. A lot of the times when you're hearing about experiences like that, I'm sitting across from someone who reminds me of my own grandparents or reminds me or doesn't look intimidating or doesn't look scary or doesn't look like someone who could ever wound someone in that way. But they're saying something that is so drastically different than their appearance or what you might expect of them.
Plus they were kids.
Yes. It's always interesting. I'm 17 years old right now, but I have people who talk about joining the military at 17, and I can't imagine that experience at my age. I don't think I have even the beginning of an understanding of what that would be like.
Now we did mention a little while back about the interviews you found with different groups of oppressed minorities.
And yes,
there were three that stood out for me. One was a 92-year-old Japanese-American man who served shortly after World War II, because during the war, he was actually moved to a relocation camp for Japanese Americans. And then there was a 75-year-old transsexual woman who served in Vietnam.
Yes.
And also a 53-year-old gay Navy veteran.
Yeah.
It was just fascinating in terms of their stories. The discrimination they faced, and in some cases, they really didn't face any.
Yeah.
The transsexual, I mean, it was surprising how little of a problem she had.
Yeah.
Was that something you sought out to get the view of the minority in service?
Yes, I did purposefully seek that out because I realized that a majority of the veterans that I was speaking to were older white men. And while their experiences are perfectly representative of what happened to them, it's not representative of the military as a whole. So I sought out, working with NAB Vets, I sought out the LGBTQ veterans group, contacting their leaders, asking if they'd be willing to send out a little message to any of their followers or anyone who's part of their program. But yeah, I sought them out on purpose just because I wanted to make sure that if I was going to be making such a huge effort to record these veteran stories, that I was making a genuine effort to involve everybody and to try and hear from as many people and as many perspectives as possible.
One last thing, Kendall, how can we find out more about you and the project and read a lot of these interviews? You have a beautiful website.
Sure. So I have a website where I've published all these interviews. I strive to upload the interviews once or twice a week, usually depending on how many I've been able to do around school and work and things like that. But it's just called Portland Veterans Project. So if you search Portland Veterans Project, it's also portlandveteransproject.com. It'll bring you to a website full of the interviews on the website, I only identify the veterans using their initials and birth year, along with a photo from that era. So while the stories are anonymous, they do have a wealth of information about their life before service, during service, and then after service, along with questions about war and morality and what they think about all those interesting little topics.
Kendall Duffy, thanks so much for joining us today at KABU.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Kendall Duffy, Portland High School senior and creator of the Portland Veterans Project. You can find out more about the project and read the interviews at her website, portlandveteransproject.com. This is Ken Jones for KABU's News in Depth.
All right, and here we are. I'm with Jamie.
Hey, Gwen.
I'm Guinevere. And we are heading up the KABU Spring Drive for fundraising. Our drive for this next 2 weeks is about smash fascism. I still can't say it. Must be my teeth.
Smash fascism and restore humanity.
Yeah. So first up, we would like to give a shout out to Ivory from Northeast Portland. She became a new member. Thank you, Ivory. I guess we're supposed to ding the bell. There you go. So we would like to encourage people to donate, become members, become involved here at KABU. Our number is 877-500-5266. We have our phone operators just waiting for your call. You could go online at kboo.fm and you could donate or give online. All amounts are appreciated. We are asking right now for a $300 donation, which is $25 a month. Hmm. Right? We upped it from the last one.
Wonderful.
In appreciation for that level of donation is a really beautiful hoodie. We keep in mind here that KABU is a volunteer-operated radio station. People come in and they do what's interesting to them. They volunteer at the level that they can. Everybody is putting the energy in according to what they're feeling and what they're capable of doing. So come on down.
Come on down and give us a shout or go online to kboo.fm and make a donation or get on the phone at 877-500-5266. I was particularly impressed by that last interview with Ken and the young high school senior delving into interviews with military veterans.
That
and
was
really,
something.
You know, KABU offers local activists a voice and doesn't just, gloom and doom, but you know, offers solutions, offers answers, not just questions. KABU programs put you in touch with these local projects, these local organizations, which are making a positive change now. And, KABU's not neutral. We're progressive. We're a local community of change makers. We're smashing fascism and restoring humanity. And we know that you're part of our community. You've been a listener. Now it's time to come up and become a member. And the only contribution too small is the one that you don't make. So get online or go to the phone, 877-500-5266. Or online at kboo.fm.
Wasn't that amazing, Jamie?
Mm-hmm.
That young woman starting out doing interviews just because she thought it was a great idea.
Yeah.
And here she is. What? Said she'd done quite a few.
Yeah, dozens.
Dozens and dozens of interviews. Mm-hmm. But she was totally connected to what she was doing, and she had an area she's interested in, and she's out there doing this, and she came over here and found somebody that would help her produce it, put her interviews online. And that's how we roll.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, that's how we roll, because you know what you're interested in, what you're doing, you come down, you're going to find somebody here who is ready, willing, and able to help you get it on the air. We do trainings. You would not believe the amount of trainings that go on here at KABU. All of this is you know, member supported, staff supported. Everything that you give, that you put into the station is awesome. So if you can handle $25 a month or $300, you know, pull over, give a stop, put your glass of wine down, dial 877-500-5266 and talk to our phone operators who are ready and willing, or go online at kboo.fm.
That's right. And you know, this Portland, you know, we're known as a progressive city, but it didn't become that way just overnight by accident. You know, 50 years of KBOO, day in, day out, has set the agenda and molded the minds of Portlanders. And if you're one of these Portland progressives who appreciates listening to KBOO, and now's the time. Does KBOO reach you? Then reach us. Does KBOO move you? Then move us. Do the right thing. Be the change. And go to the phone, 877-500-5266. Or online at kboo.fm, and consider making a $25 a month donation. You just set it up through your bank account or your credit card, and you hardly even notice it.
Right?
We need it.
We do. And, you know, we have a building here that's owned by KBOO, and it needs some upkeep. And us as volunteers, we're doing bits and pieces as we can. And donations help out with that kind of support towards the building. We have, you know, projects. We have antennas. We have engineering. There's a whole lot of physical things that happen to make this station on air, keep it alive, keep it happening, so we can bring these different things to you. So please give us a call, 877-500-5266, or go online at kboo.fm. Every bit is appreciated.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Milo's City Cafe. Owned and operated by a Portland family since 1999, Milo's City Cafe has been serving the Northeast Portland community breakfast, lunch, and dinner for 20 years. Located at 1325 Northeast Broadway Street, Milo's specializes in traditional American breakfast and brunch every day from morning to afternoon and in the evening. Lunch was provided by Grandma Joyce's Kitchen, an up-and-coming family-based catering service, providing Southern-style cuisine. Grandma Joyce can be reached through Facebook at Grandma Joyce's Kitchen. Dinner was provided by Brazil Grill. Locally owned and operated, Brazil Grill serves up Brazilian steak with the traditional churrasco method. Located in Portland's Downtown Arts District at 1201 Southwest 12th Avenue, Brazil Grill is open daily for dinner. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 right now.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, April 15th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen The 40-Year-Old Virgin, starring Steve Carell, Catherine Keener, and more in this romantic comedy.